Welcome, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to the Power of Voices podcast presented to you by the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs, hosted by Jeroen Kelderhuis, head of the Civil Society and Education Division. This podcast series is linked to the policy framework for strengthening civil society, and we will focus specifically on the core elements that are at the basis of this framework. In this podcast, we will be talking about the hashtag and movement of Shift to Power. Today, we have two guests who play a central and active role in the Shift to Power movement.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the second episode of the Power of Voices podcast. So we've got two great guests with us today. Jenny Hutchen is Executive Director and Founder of the Global Fund for Community Foundation and is a leading voice on community philanthropy. She's also working with one of our partnerships, namely the Giving for Change Partnership, which is part of the consortium led by the Stichting Wilde Gansen Consortium. Jenny is currently based in South Africa. Welcome, Jenny. Could you please tell us a little bit more about your work at the Fund for Community Foundation and what motivated you to start working in development aid?
Thank you, Jeroen. It's a pleasure to be here. The Global Fund for Community Foundations and works at the edge of development, I think I could say, of formal development. And that has been my own personal experience too. My experience of working in this space was very much shaped by the experience of spending some time in Uganda shortly. So I came to community philanthropy both from that sort of very grassroots experience, but also from a more systemic, how does civil society embed itself within communities and gain the trust of people? So as an organization over the last 16 years, the Global Fund for Community Foundations has really focused on that kind of emergence of community philanthropy, local resource mobilization, the organizing and stewarding of local resources, not just a way of funding civil society, but also building relationships and trust and buy-in and constituency for its work.
Thank you. We'll come back to that later. And we're also very proud to have with us today Charles Koyo van Dijk. Charles is based in Ghana and is the head of the Capacity Development Unit, West Africa Civil Society Institute, WACSI. Welcome, Charles, and likewise, please, can you tell us a bit about yourself and your motivations to work in development aid?
Yeah, thanks so much for this invitation. I'm happy to be part of today's conversation. So currently I work for the West Africa Civil Society Institute, as you mentioned, based in Accra. My journey into the development space was to some extent quite unconventional. I studied banking and finance for my undergraduate degree. Then I realized that that sector was not for me, and I needed to find a space where I could naturally express myself and make an impact on the quality of life of people and communities. So I decided to enter into the world of international development through, first of all, a graduate degree in development management. But interestingly, for as long as I remember, I've always been passionate about the potential of people and communities in Africa. So in my formative years, when I was really young, I was blessed to experience growing up in four different African countries with similar but also peculiar kind of development trajectories. So I always instinctively knew that I'll find expression and fulfillment working on social justice and international development issues. So I'll just say my motivation is driven from my lived experience growing up, schooling, working, and currently living in Africa.
Thank you. So we have people around the table here who really want to make a difference. And but making a difference is not always that easy. And more you hear the topic in the development aid sector, shifting the power. This movement and discussion has become more prominent in our sector for a few years now. And Jenny, as the person who started the shift to power as a hashtag, basically, which was then picked up worldwide. Maybe you can share with us a bit the idea behind this Shift to Power hashtag and the movement that was created afterwards.
Sure. Well, the unglamorous version of the story is this. We were organizing a conference back in 2016. It was the first global summit on community philanthropy. And we brought together 400 people from 70 countries around the world. And it was meant to be a real kind of celebration of this emerging movement practice sort of theories of alternative resourcing for civil society. But I was very clear in my mind at the time that what we didn't want to do was to create an industry conference. So if you knew what community philanthropy was, you'd come. If you didn't, you wouldn't. Because for me, the role of community philanthropy is not just an instrumental fix. This wasn't going to be a how-to kind of event. To me, the role of community philanthropy was really to be part of larger conversations that had been sort of bubbling up for some time around power. We had no budget for communications, so we thought, well, let's get a punchy hashtag that really kind of puts our cards on the table and is a call as an invitation for those who are interested in the current dynamics in the system and the importance of alternative approaches and some of the issues around power. The framing was really meant to invite organizations who often themselves sort of experienced were sort of on the underside of kind of conversations around power, really to come together and say, actually, power is critically important here. So it was really around that event. And over the course of the few days of the conference itself, it just sort of took on a momentum of its own kind of globally on social media. But it was also an event that if you were there, you won't forget it in a long time. People coming together and really kind of going, wow, there is something else out there. There is an alternative way of being and doing, and I'm not doing it on my own. I have colleagues here from Russia and Uruguay and Uganda and, you know, you name it. So that was the origins of the hashtag. And we had a fix around communications at the time, but it was also really about putting the issue on the table front and center rather than just sort of dancing around the edges.
Yeah, well, sometimes things start small but become very big. And well, you make it sound that it started a bit spontaneously, but in one of the articles you were quoted, you said the deliberate use of the hashtag shift to power was intended to provoke. Who and what did you want to provoke with that hashtag? and what end goal did you want to achieve?
You know, I think philanthropy and development aid are often very polite sectors. Mm-hmm. We use, development language, jargonese, we talk in projects and capacities and all, you know, this sort of thing. And sometimes we kind of lose the heart and soul of what this work is about, because often when you get, you know, I think of the numbers of conversations I've had with partners and colleagues around the world describing their discomfort with how they felt that their organizations were being treated, perceived, overlooked, dismissed, tried to squeeze into boxes that didn't really fit them. And really one of the issues around this was this dimension of power, that whoever, you know, has the money calls the shots. In the famous words of Kim Klein, who's just an amazing fundraiser based in the US, she said, you know, whoever funds you owns you. And that issue that funding always comes with power. And even if you're a Southern funder, that comes with power too. So to really try and encourage that, you know, a conversation about power might be uncomfortable, but if we're really talking about tackling complex issues increasingly in today's modern world, we need to embrace that complexity and some of the dynamics that are not often immediately visible in exchanges around development aid, but you just have to scratch beneath the surface and they are clearly there. So it really was to say, okay, let's have this conversation together. Let's feel comfortable. Let's feel challenged, all of us, wherever we sit. This wasn't finger wagging at only certain actors. It was also kind of finger wagging at ourselves, is let's think about our power and how we use it. So in that sense, it was meant to provoke a different kind of a conversation, which wasn't just a sort of an instrumental fix. I think in the development sector and in philanthropy, we're so keen to look for simple silver bullets. If I just introduce this, this will change, without really looking at that kind of some of those underlying issues and dynamics and tensions. And to me, these are critical and essential if we're really going to move our work forward and transform the system that we're operating in.
Yeah. Charles, I listened to you in several other podcasts and in some articles and other performances that you did lately. I mean, you're also very much in the center of this debate. What does the movement Shift to Power mean to you, Charles?
Yeah, just to say, I absolutely agree with everything Jenny has said. But for me, to shift the power is an empowering and kind of a nurturing community of solidarity. And I think that's where the emphasis should be. That has put a spotlight on the value knowledge, assets, and capabilities of citizens, groups, and communities in the Global South, and which often don't get the spotlight for the kind of amazing work that they are doing. So I believe that our movement has highlighted the power of the diversity of civil society in the Global South, in all its different formations. So we have a very dynamic and diverse civil society. I also believe the Shift the Power movement has increased the urgency to tackle uncomfortable realities like structural racism, power asymmetry, and resource inequalities within the international development aid system. So for me, Shift the Power means doing development in a way that enables individuals, organizations, communities to determine, plan, and execute their own development agenda. This is something that we are yearning for in the Global South. It also means how we can, those of us who work in this space, how we can strengthen the position and participation of communities in that development process in terms of, you know, opportunities to lead in making decisions, in terms of taking responsibility and really leading from the front. So this is what Shift the Power means to me.
Yeah. Well, myself, I've been working in development aid for quite some years now. But terms like solidarity, treasuring local knowledge and expertise, ownership has always been part of the jargon in development aid. Why does the Shift the Power movement get so much attention now, Jenny?
Sure. Well, I think the last couple of years have been significant. I mean, clearly last year with COVID and Black Lives Matter protests, I think there was a kind of a moment which really shone a light on some of the systemic inequalities in the system. You know, the number of people I spoke to around the world, you know, who had money in their banks for development projects, but the money was frozen because COVID meant they couldn't do their work and they weren't able to redeploy resources to do that. So there was money stuck in the system, international staff pulled out of countries, and, you know, communities fell back on their own resources. And I think that we experienced that as a phenomenon around the world. But I think really understanding what happened during COVID and what we can learn from it was really, you know, I think it was a sort of dress rehearsal for what we're going to see more of increasingly around the climate emergency. You need resources on the ground that you can deploy quickly to networks that you know and trust to get things done. I think the Black Lives Matter protests really sent massive ripple effects for the first time really in such a concerted way through the formal development aid and philanthropic sectors, suddenly reflecting on their own systems and structures and ways of working and how decisions were made and such like. So I think there was this sort of convergence of factors. The last 5-10 years has been that increasing realization amongst Global South actors as well, of realizing that actually if they can pull together and express greater solidarity and grow that demand side for systems change, I think that helped too. So to me, this was happening anyway, but I think it sped up massively over the course of the last 18 months or so.
Yeah. So Building Back Better, Black Lives Matters, the COVID crisis, really led to a different conversation, to speeding up things that were already under the surface, maybe. But do we really notice a change now? Because this has been going on for more than a year now. Are people going back to their old positions, or do we really see a change happening? Do new alliances emerge, new collaborations emerge, and become stronger? Charles, do you really see this also in practice, or is it getting stuck a bit in more academic conversations?
I think there's a greater appetite and action within international development now to consider alternative ways of engaging with communities and development organizations. So I just want to give an example. So for example, at the public policy level, like in the Global South, there's been a greater urgency now to undertake a much deeper examination of aid systems, structure and delivery. A good example is the Power of Voices initiative, which in my view is a significant improvement from the norm in terms of levels of participation and engagement of Southern organizations in development processes. Earlier on in the year, the International Development Committee of the UK Parliament organized a series of hearings on international aid. I actually think that some of the hearings are still going on. So there are similar conversations going on in other European countries and to some extent in the US, Canada, and Australia. So there's a certain impetus and recognition that development must be done differently and more effectively. And then, of course, some of the stuff that we've already mentioned, the growing global network of bold, innovative initiatives that is contributing to effecting this change. So, for example, the Shift the Power movement that we've been talking about, the reimagining INGO systems change process that is going on, the localization movement, the decolonizing aid movements, institutions like Disrupt Development, Black Lives Matter movement, continental movements such as Africans Rising. So there are alliances and collaborations that are being nurtured. But I still believe that we still have a long way to go to reverse the systemic challenges.
Jenny, how do you see this?
I would agree completely with what Charles has said. And I think, you know, one of the real opportunities we have is yes, this sort of setting a tone around movement generosity and solidarity. You know, we are in a competitive system where, you know, if I get money, maybe Charles doesn't. So why would I share anything with Charles? So we've, in a sense, how one takes control of this kind of movement growing work, I think, becomes critically important. I agree with Charles. I think, you know, the Power of Voices program from the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs is critically important for a bilateral funder to say, you know, we can set a tone for a different kind of conversation. But you're also seeing it in the private philanthropic space, increased interest in participatory grant making. And the coming together of the building of pathways between southern networks. So I think part of this is also it requires us all to break out of our categories and really to kind of to start weaving together more of our kind of collective wisdom and our kind of political might in all of this to start thinking around, you know, how can we all do this much better? So I think those conversations are starting to happen. I still think it's still incredibly hard if you are a Global South organization living on a project-to-project basis and having to deliver activities for what is still largely an unreconstructive aid sector to actually find the time intellectually to reflect, to design, to co-create. And to me, this seems critically important. I agree with Charles, it's not happening fast enough. And we need these spaces for that kind of co-creation and emergence to happen because many people are just exhausted and stressed as it is. I am seeing a little bit of reassertion of old power. You know, these are existential crises and questions for organizations that have been around a long time and starting to question their own sort of existence, I think creates a discomfort and perhaps sometimes a desire to hold on to things how they are and recreate a new logic for why they should maintain their system as it is. So I think it's a very interesting sort of disruptive and kind of messy time, but now is the time really to start trying to forge this all forward.
Yeah. No, I'm myself working for a donor, a government donor institute, listening to all these conversations, localization, decolonization of aid, the urgency of the discussion. I sometimes also feel that if we get too much into this debate and we might think maybe we should restart the whole thing, reset the whole thing, and give all the power to our colleagues in the Global South and so-called Northern Hemisphere. I'm trying to dip a bit deeper into the essence of what we are talking about because some people might also think or might be afraid to throw away the child with the bathwater and we end up with empty hands in the end because we also need each other, I suppose. So Charles, should we not talk about more sharing the power equally and more about listening better, do better context analysis and dive deeper before into a conversation about what do people need before we start development aid in certain contexts? Is it not more about sharing power, sitting around the table together, and as Jenny said, co-create things together?
Yeah, I mean that's a very interesting, thought-provoking questions, really, really great questions. But I believe sincerely that it's not an issue about Western or Northern organization leaving or exiting the Global South. I think if we pursue this kind of argument, it makes the issue quite simplistic. Mm-hmm. So we live in an interconnected world, and of course, COVID has shown this, and we have built relationships over long periods of time. So we cannot wash away history and our present realities. So the issue, in my view, is about whether the existing relationships, partnerships, or collaborations are just, equitable, respectful, and reciprocal. And I believe that the challenge for all of us, and when I say all of us, I mean all of us who work within global civil society, and like Jenny emphasized, is to co-construct a development paradigm that enables communities and individuals to be at the forefront of their own development journeys. So this is the challenge that confronts all of us. And I believe that conversations we're having today, such as the one we're having right now, kind of helps, you know, first of all, to shift the mindsets in both the North and the South, and to chart kind of a pathway for this change to happen. The truth is, change is always a constant. And so I think we need to embrace the change that is happening, because the change is happening.
Yeah. Working for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, I mean, we are very aware of our role, of our power also in a way as a funding agency. But there's also reasons behind why things have been constructed. In one of your articles, Charles, you talk about the challenges within the current funding structure. What are the biggest problems, you think, in this funding structure?
I think some of them, of the challenges we have, can be traced to, first of all, short-term, ad hoc, activity-driven funding. So still very little long-term flexible kind of funding for both supporting initiatives and supporting the vehicles that actually do this work. These are the organizations, the institutions, the groupings. And I believe that more funding needs to find its way to community groups and actors. This is where I believe the potential of transformative change actually happens.
I think we, you know, one of the sort of blind spots of funders is that funders often expect to deliver kind of 360 degree change through their particular type of capital. And so if it's bilateral aid, that's a particular type of money that has a particular type of accountability. So it also comes with particular limitations. If you're a philanthropic funder, you know, that's often comes with less different kinds of requirements, so it can play a different kind of role. But the bit that often gets missed is the local contributions. And I think we need to think about architecture and frameworks, which, as Charles said, really put communities at the heart of it, because Shift the Power is not just a call from Global North to Global South. It really is an interrogation of all our systems and structures and organizational forms, which through their very design can hoard and hold power. So that could happen in London or Nairobi. It makes no difference, because we know, I mean, there are historic reasons why development aid must continue to come to countries. You know, colonialism, there's a lot of history there that needs to be kind of addressed. So that money must continue to come, but come in ways that doesn't undermine or dismiss what's already there. And I think that really is about organizational design. You know, what is the structure that can facilitate and enable and that can be nimble enough to reach people where they are, but it also can organize as a kind of collective so that it has power and voice and can, you know, exert its own influence, whether at national or regional or international levels. And I think we need to be thinking much more sort of ways that are fluid, like how could we build these structures and move away from our absolute preoccupation with buying outcomes. Like, yes, we can still buy outcomes, but we need to use some of the resources to actually invest in the systems and structures that will facilitate flows, that will facilitate people, and where the center of gravity is people and their aspirations and their needs and addressing the issues that confront them, you know, particularly of those on the edges of our society. And I'm always sort of struck by our inability still to stand alongside each other different types of money in the system. So, you know, €1 million that comes in development aid, what happens if you have 1 million people giving €1? I mean, that represents something very different. So if you've got 100 people giving a dollar each, for example, that's 100 people saying, we believe in this and we believe in collective action and we trust this organization to do something for us. So I think we're not very good at really sort of seeing that different kinds of financial capital come with different values associated with them, all of which we need. We know that trust is critical to getting any of this work done. And often money undermines trust. It doesn't help build it. So I think we just need to challenge ourselves to be able to work with the kind of harder and softer kind of tools that we work with now. I mean, I think at the moment the system is very much in favor of the harder, measurable, what did my money buy kind of thing. And we really lose sight of the behavior change, of the element of trust and buy-in and all those kinds of things, which are always simmering beneath the surface in any communities. People are organizing their resources based on trust and empathy and mutuality, but somehow our systems aren't really equipped to see those in the way that they should.
Yeah. No, there are different reasons, of course, for giving, empathy, solidarity. But giving is not that easy as it sounds, because there's also sometimes very much unintended consequences that you didn't foresee, etc. As a government donor agency, I mean, we of course also have our own agendas as well. It's of course solidarity. The people who pay tax in the Netherlands, millions of them, want to show their solidarity by helping people abroad. But they also expect us to do such a thing and represent Dutch values. Sometimes also you might want to support movements in a certain context, women movements, LGBTI movements, that really need our assistance, but actually we might not be allowed to help these groups. Do you see a potential conflict, Charles, between shifting the power on the one hand and the wish to support Dutch priorities and internationally agreed rights as a problem?
So I believe if we shift the power and you know, the relationships will be more coordinated and empowering, because these relationships will be developed, like Jenny said, beyond funding or resource considerations and interests. They will be value driven, and then Global South engagement with the Global North will be based on what I call a co-investment paradigm, right? Where we really look at everybody's assets and what they are bringing along, and not the premium just being money, because there are all sorts of other assets, assets from communities, from networks, expertise, trust, etc. People respond to different issues differently. So it's not just about getting funds to an LGBTI activist, but it's also about understanding the context in which that activist is living and the social change that is being pursued at that material time, and the appetite for change within that specific community, and this idea that they need money. Because you would agree that most of the issues that we deal with are very much multidimensional, right? And so it means it needs a certain approach that is not just about money, but also understanding what is happening in that specific community and how communities are responding to that issue. And that's why I believe that INGOs still have a significant role to play. The only thing is that I believe that their roles should be a little bit more empowering and should go beyond just direct implementation. They could play roles of facilitator. They could play roles of convening. They could act as a bridge to facilitate resource sharing and transfer. They could be great partners in terms of capacity development, creating spaces for, you know, like communities of solidarity or practice. For learning, for documentation of indigenous and alternative practices. So, I mean, INGOs, there's still a huge contribution that INGOs should make. But these contributions should add value to the community, strengthen the ability of communities to be able to chart their own development agenda and respond to the issues that are of priority to those communities.
Yeah. No, and often donors want too much too quickly, and actually we need time to build trust, to understand each other better, to understand the context better, and then also see and share the agenda setting, right? Like decide yes. together what are the priorities that need to be addressed and in what time frame. And then, of course, listening becomes very important and key, I think. Are we as donors failing to listen to whom our aid is actually intended? And how can we improve this sitting together, this co-creation this building trust, Jenny?
That's a big question. I think donors still are not listening well. I just think but donors are caught in a system where, you know, it's a five-year program and it's got to focus on a tangible issue. And so already we're in the business of starting to kind of deviate from a more holistic, long-term way of understanding community. I think we have to embrace that complexity and not romanticize community as a single thing. I was talking to a group in Kenya last year during COVID, and they were reflecting on how COVID had really kind of brought back the sense of their work as a social movement, as a community, and how the funding that they had received, you know, well-intentioned, good funding to address their issue, they had really realized it had begun to kind of ossify them, to kind of bureaucratize them. And, you know, that they had lost the sort of heart and soul of what it was they were doing. You know, here I think that the work of the Global Fund for Community Foundations, the partners that we work with, I think this, the importance of movement or community proximate funders and grant makers. You know, we work with women's funds, community foundations, LGBTQI foundations, socio-environmental funds. These are, and equally, while they are also trying to kind of grow those cultures of giving, as soon as communities start to give to them, it changes their accountability completely. So that it allows them to go back to funders saying, well, you might want to do that. But some of our other donors, our local donors and partners, don't want us to do that. So I think it's really about, it's not just, it's donor funding landing on fertile territory where there is a community, there is trust, there are resources mobilized, and how can it help build and grow that out? We know when there is distrust, it costs more, it costs funders more, it costs more to get stuff done. You know, thriving, effective, trusting communities who are working together, you know, it's much easier. They need fewer resources in many ways because they've got the most critical one there, which is actually that kind of vision and connectedness of doing things together. So I think it does go back to the framings that we use, where we see international development aid as one source, one valuable source of financing and other kinds of networks and contacts and that sort of thing, but not the sole one. So it's sort of the, you know, that that we start, this becomes an investment in a much larger vision of change, which is based on core values around, you know, dignity and rights and inclusion and such like. But I think that's an area that there's still quite a lot of work we need to do collectively on, and not just, you know, the primacy of the donor vision is still incredibly strong, and it creates ripple effects in southern actors too, who respond to donors saying, tell us what you need us to look like in order to access your money, rather than saying, see us who we are and what we can do and how your money actually can land better if you work with us. So I think these conversations are starting to happen, but they need to happen at a much greater scale and speed and depth, I would say.
Yeah. No, thank you. I know from, I mean, the organization that I work for, the Netherlands Ministry of Foreign Affairs, we are very much open to this kind of feedback about how to listen better, how to assist with systemic change, how to make more use of indigenous resources, etc. So Charles, if you would be my boss from tomorrow and you would become the Naval Minister of Development Cooperation of the Netherlands, sure. What would you change first?
Let me just say something funny. With my surname, I probably can.
Yeah.
<I'm> just kidding.
Why not?
So I think one of the things I would say is that three things. How do we design our programs, our initiatives and partnerships to invest more in supporting community-led development and community philanthropy or the local giving infrastructure within the Global South? That's one area I'll say we should invest in. Another area I think we should invest in is how do we open up civic space? So how do we support the opening up of civic space, really fight the shrinking space that is really pervasive within the Global South and even to some extent in the Global North? And then the third thing will be, let us now find partners. Let's find, how do we change our mindset from this charity mindset to a co-investment mindset, where we look for partners, look at what they are doing, and then co-invest with them in a process, or co-construct or co-create with them in a process. And while we are doing that, we should also be mindful of the kind of support we provide. So more flexible, long-term funding, especially for community-based organizations, self-help groups, movements, and informal associations. So those would be the three areas that I think I would say we should really invest our energy, our time into.
Jenny, and if you would become the minister, would you say the same things?
Yeah, I would. I think that everything Charles has said is really important, and there's just something about unlearning. I mean, I would institute some kind of big unlearning program of really kind of going back to basics and almost providing everyone with glasses, with a lens that allowed them to see what was out there a bit more clearly, making the invisible more visible. I think this might not be, you know, possible in practical terms, but, you know, philosophically, that kind of get out of these big structures and kind of start from the position of where people are and what already exists, and somehow, it is the burden of big organizations that you, if you work for a big organization, you actually never have to speak to anyone outside your organization because you can busily organize meetings with each other the entire time. So maybe it's just about getting out a bit more and finding ways to kind of dip into the very vibrant conversations that are happening in different pockets around the world that aren't always immediately visible but are hugely valuable.
Yes, thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation. Charles, Jenny, thank you so much. And I hope we can stay in touch to further this debate, this very important debate. I know we are very much open to this discussions at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Netherlands, but we're just one of many players. And I think there is an opportunity now to have this conversation, because I know people are open to this, and it's also necessary given the current challenges we have as a shared world community. Thank you so much, and let's stay in touch.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.